continues with Britten and Beethoven from the cellist Natalie Klein. Hear it live on BBC Radio 3 as part of our season of music and programmes marking the composer's centenary, Britten 100. Tomorrow lunchtime at 1 o'clock.
Back to this lunchtime. The time now is just after 1 o'clock. This is Ian Skelly with a summary of the BBC News here on Radio 3. The former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, has appealed for cross-party support after claiming victory in the country's general election. Unofficial results from yesterday's vote suggest his Muslim League party won the most seats but may need to form a coalition. Mr. Sharif, who's now 63, was deposed from power by a coup in 1999 and served several years in jail before being exiled. Nine people have been arrested in Turkey in connection with yesterday's bomb attack near the Syrian border, in which more than 40 people were killed. The Turkish government has said it suspects Syria's intelligence service was involved in the attack in Reyhanli, which is a common crossing point for refugees. The Syrian government has denied committing the attack. The Education Secretary, Michael Gove, has become the first member of the current cabinet to say he would vote for Britain to leave the European Union if a referendum was held now. But speaking to the BBC, he said his preference was for a change in the UK's relationship with the EU and that he supported David Cameron's plan to renegotiate the conditions of membership and then hold a public vote. The government has insisted that hospitals are best placed to determine staffing levels after senior nurses warned that patients were being put at risk on many wards in England. The Safe Staffing Alliance, which includes the Royal College of Nursing and the Patients Association, said nurses were often having to look after more than eight patients, substantially increasing the risk of harm or death. British scientists have said they hope a new type of wheat they've developed will help farmers feed the world's growing population. It's thought the variety, which is bred from ancient and modern grains, could increase production by a third. Pope Francis has created more than 800 new saints. Most of those honoured were Italians from the 15th century who were killed for refusing to convert to Islam. And the weather, rain across western and central areas of Britain will continue to move eastwards during the afternoon. It'll become clearer in most places by early evening, leaving some scattered showers, mainly in northwestern Scotland. And that's the BBC News and weather. It's 3 minutes past one. So on to the early music show. And Catherine Bott surveys the work of the vocal ensemble Tonus Peregrinus. The programme opens with a recording from their latest release of works from the Eton Choir Book, a 13-part canon by Robert Wilkinson.
Rea tonem. a dense 13-part canon all built up on Jesus autem transiens. And transiens is a very significant word, but Jesus passing through them. The music passes to all sorts of places in this amazing piece by Robert Wilkinson from the 15th century Eton choir book. It was performed on their latest recording by the ensemble Tonus Peregrinus. There's going to be much more music from the Eton choir book later in today's early music show, and today we're focusing on the work of the group, whose website Bill Matter calls it authentic and original, an ensemble for new and old music. With me in the studio is Anthony Pitts, who founded Tonus Peregrinus in 1990 when he was a scholar at New College, Oxford. Welcome, Anthony. Now, this is the early music show, but I can't help noticing that you've put the word new before old on your website homepage. What are the aims of Tonus Peregrinus?
The very first recording we did was, in fact, entirely instrumental, and that was of a piece of mine, a kind of chamber symphony called Music for a Large Audience. So that was new. And the very first gig we did was Arvo Pärt's St John Passion back in 1990 in New College, Oxford, in the chapel there. So that was also new. But old music, to begin with, mostly 16th century, actually, Tallis and Bird and White and so on, was always part of what I was doing, what I was singing with other people. And that became a very staple part of our repertoire in the early years and has remained so.
Well, your peregrinations have taken you a long way since 1990. Tell me about your series, The Milestones of Western Music. I mean, it's full of musical firsts, and that's going to be mirrored in the music that you've chosen for us to hear in today's programme.
They're all significant works, really, because, as you say, they're all firsts. They all show a new stage, the beginning of something new in the history of Western music. Basically, music that's in every textbook for students of music history.
So, the historical anthology of music that I've had since I was at school, HAM, you're putting it on disc, and jolly good too. We're going to hear some Perrotin from Notre Dame. What would you say is the defining characteristic of this melismatic music?
I think the most important thing about this music is in fact, the building that it was written for, as far as we can tell, and certainly was sung in, and that's the building of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And in making this recording, we didn't record it there, we recorded it in an abbey in Provence. We went to Notre Dame to get a sense of the space, the acoustics, and that really influenced the way that we've interpreted this music. So we do it quite slowly, and we do it with a great sense of space around it. So back then, and this piece is from the very end of the 12th century, possibly early 13th century, they just had a different sense of time. Things moved much more slowly. You know, they had time to build a cathedral, which takes 50, 60 years. And this piece is extraordinary. It just goes on and on and on.
Thank you.
part of Perrotin's Sederunt Principes, sung by Tonus Peregrinus, directed by my guest today on the Early Music Show, Anthony Pitts. Is this typical of what was going on in Western music at the time it was written, or is this really groundbreaking stuff?
Our history of music is basically a history of music that's been written down. So, you know, otherwise it's not recorded, it's not remembered. So the first music that gets written down is plain chant, you know, simple tunes. And then by the end of the 12th century, which is when Sederunt Principes was written, we've moved a long way already, because we've got not just a drone underneath a chant, but we've got a drone with three parts on top, and also all four parts moving together in a fast, dancey rhythm, where they've worked out how to constrain the rhythm, how to write it down. And so this is a big step forward that really parallels the Gothic architecture of the cathedral itself. You know, they've also worked out how to have these different levels, how to build huge structures, how to keep up the walls, how to stop them falling in. And it's the same with the harmony. They've worked out how to put three more parts on top of basically a tune.
Let's just backtrack a little to those early days in Oxford and welcome a singer who's been working with the group for more than 20 years, soprano Joanna Forbes-Lestrange. Now, I know you as a consummate studio singer, and these days commercial music tends to be very demanding in terms of impossibly high notes held at pianissimo dynamic for about a week, and you are brilliant at that. Now, there are parallels, aren't there, with some of the very early music you sing with Tonus Peregrinus. What are the special challenges for a singer, do you think?
Gosh, yes, there certainly are parallels. Whenever I'm singing Shepherd or Tallis or Ty, especially in those Clerks of Oxenford versions, David Wilson versions with the very stratospheric high soprano lines, I do think I'm using exactly the same techniques here as I do on a film session. But mainly I find I do enjoy singing high. I do, if I can get it right and if I can relax, I just love the sensation of singing high and quiet.
Well, the next music we're going to hear is very different from what we've heard so far. It's been called the first ever opera. I tend to think of it as perhaps the first ever musical. This is the play of Robin and Marian by Adam de la Halle. Anthony, he's a rather one of those little is known about composers, isn't he?
Yes, and there's very little music here as well. It's just tunes, basically. It's tunes strung together with a load of words. So he's a composer and a poet at the same time, just as Guillaume de Machaut is in the next century, in the 14th century. So we had to make an English version of the text, which you can hear on the disc, as well as the old French. And the tunes, I mean, we had to basically arrange them with as many medieval instruments as we could find. I ended up playing a bagpipe, drone, cow horns, not to forget coconuts.
I couldn't possibly forget the coconuts.
and tried to make something which is, you know, fun. It's a fun recording.
Which bit have you chosen for us to hear now?
The knight has just left Marian, so the knight is trying to woo
that's
her.
That's knight with a K.
Yes.
It's not Daybreak.
Confusingly, Marian is sung by Catherine Knight.
With a K.
anyway, so that the knight has just been trying to woo the shepherdess Marian, unsuccessfully, because she's a pretty strong character. And so we hear these drums as he rides off into the distance. And then we have a kind of little break, a little interlude. We have two rondos. And after the two rondo, we hear what's really one of the loveliest tunes. It's very simple and very catchy, Hey Robichon. And that's sung by both Marian and Robin, sung here by Alexander Lestrange, as he approaches her. Thank you.
to?
Very merry.
What have you been up to?
D'où viens-tu?
Voices and instruments of Tonus Peregrinus in an excerpt from Le Jeu de Robin et de Marion by Adam de la Halle. Joanna Forbes-Lestrange, that sounds as if it was great fun to record.
It was. It was very much a departure for us, actually. I don't think we'd ever recorded, in fact, we hadn't ever recorded anything dramatic involving speech and instruments and so on. So it was a really fun recording, that one.
Anthony, would you consider staging it? For real?
I think I'd run a mile before staging it. We have staged quite similar things, like Guillaume de Machaut's Le Voyeur de Die, The Book of the True Story, which is also a mixture of old French and English and music and movement as well. But this could be staged. It'd be quite a challenge.
You up for that, Joe?
How's your horse riding skills?
Well, our next music is another of Tonus Peregrinus's famous firsts that you so specialise in. This is the first polyphonic mass setting. Anthony, tell me, what is the significance of this piece?
Well, it's one of these milestones of Western music, and it's a very interesting piece. It's actually a collection of different movements by probably different people, early 14th century. I have this mental picture of Western musical history, which is a bit like the development of an individual from childhood through adolescence into various stages of adulthood and beyond. And, you know, this whole period, the kind of the late medieval period, is the rebellious teenagers, the striking individuality. There's all sorts of experimentation going on, but there's a sense they're not completely self-aware, not completely sure of their identity. And here in the Mass sur Tournée, in this particular credo, the setting of the creed, which is basically the same rhythm throughout, it's like they're saying, well, we'll all sing the tune and then we'll add these different notes on top and we'll see what it sounds like.
Thank you.
The credo from the anonymous early 14th century Mass of Tournai, sung by Tonus Peregrinus. And you're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott. With me in the studio is the founder and director of Tonus Peregrinus, Anthony Pitts, and singer Joanna Forbes-Lestrange. Who would have sung this repertoire originally, that Mass of Tournai? And how much does it matter to replicate those forces now?
We know, I think, with the Mass of Tournai that it would have been sung by six singers, possibly nine on higher feast days. So we're pretty close in terms of numbers. I think we were doing it there with seven or eight. It's always been really important to choose voices and timbres that can manage to blend in these quite low registers for the women, certainly.
Ultimately, although us early music people do care deeply about authentic performance, and obviously Anthony is a huge champion of authentic performance, I think ultimately, is the music beautiful? Does it sound beautiful? And all sorts of decisions in those early days when the pieces were first written would have been based on what sounds nice to the ear, what is aesthetically pleasing to the ear. Ficta, for example, we don't worry too much in Tonus Peregrinus about, is that definitely going to be a sharp or a flat? We have a discussion about it. What sounds nice? That sounds nice. Let's do that. And for me, what sounds nice is to have those high sopranos on top of those textures. I mean, the Eton Choir Book recording is just... It just sounds wonderful, and I think it does work very well. So, and it's beautiful, so why not?
For the rest of the programme, we're going to concentrate on English composers. John Dunstable is the next name that comes up. What for you is most distinctive about his writing?
I call Dunstable the godfather of the musical renaissance because he's the one who brings into music a new sense of harmonic direction, full triads, where you've got the, to be technical, you've got the root, the third and the fifth all at the same time.
Bum, bum, bum.
We've heard that before in 14th century music, but he uses it. He actually uses it as a way to move somewhere else. When I first came across Dunstable, when I was a student, I thought it was really rather dull. I mean, I looked at the editions and it's all white notes and it just kind of goes on for pages and pages. But having then had to come to terms with it and being told, well, we'd like a recording of this, I had to work out where you put the sharps and the flats. And suddenly, to me, to my ears, it came to life. The colour came back. It was like restoring a medieval fresco where the colours have gone. And often adding these sharps and flats means you get clashes between different parts. But that's, of course, a distinctive part of English music. And in the Dunstable track we're about to hear, you can hear those false relations that we've come to know and love in 16th century music of Tallis and Byrd and so on.
some classically English quirkiness and scrunchiness in that Credo by John Dunstable. Anthony Pitts, why is that English music? We know it is as we listen to it somehow.
It is the enjoyment. I think he's reveling in the harmonic fullness, the fact that you've got these full chords, as we were saying before, and then he juxtaposes them with chords on different degrees of the scale, and you get these clashes as well. And it's extraordinary to think that over the course of 50 years, we go from Dunstable, who died in 1453, to the collection which we know as the Eton Choir Book at the end of the 15th century. So much has changed. The vocal ranges have expanded enormously. In the Eton Choir Book, we're talking about music over a range of 3 octaves or more, with those high, soaring treble lines. The harmonic control has changed. There's suddenly a real sense of self-assurance, which, as I was saying earlier, when you see the development of polyphony of Western musical history over half a millennium, you can see this is the point that where we've grown up. You know, this is us.
Not the rebellious teenager anymore.
Know,
this is grown-up music.
I think so. This is someone, you know, leaving the house and setting up on their own. The harmony is really well ordered. The actual polyphony, the different lines, are beautifully managed over very long spans, very syncopated.
So what have you chosen for us to hear from the Eton Choir Book?
Well, I've chosen this setting of the Magnificat. There are, in fact, 24 settings of the Magnificat in the Eton Choir Book, and it's by Hugh Kellick, and I think ours is the first recording, or certainly the first commercial recording of it. And it's just such a happy piece. I mean, the words themselves, of course, are very, very joyful. Mary's song of praise and prophecy, when she knows she's going to bring forth the Messiah. And this setting is just staggering, the way it soars up and so much intricate detail, which again, we talked with Perrottin about how the building influenced the music. And I think here you've got those examples of English architecture at the time. You know, think of the ceiling of King's College Chapel or so on, or Eton itself.
Two establishments that are quite closely connected through Henry VI.
Exactly. And I think that joy in detail, in fact, of course, in architectural detail, which you can't see because it's up so high and it's hidden behind pillars and that sort of thing. And it's the same thing here. This is absolutely singer's music. I mean, it's so good to sing.
Anthony, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
a setting of the Magnificat from the Eton Choir Book by Hugh Kellick, and it was performed by Tonus Peregrinus under their founder and director, Anthony Pitts. And you may like to know that printed editions of much of the music recorded by Tonus Peregrinus in their Milestones of Western Music is available via their website. The Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott, and the programme was produced by Helen Garrison. Stay with us on Radio 3 for the music of Wagner and Schumann from Wales.
A special edition of Jazz Lineup this weekend on BBC Radio 3 as part of the celebrations of the 2013 City of Culture in Derry, Londonderry. Jazz Lineup goes to the city's Jazz and Big Band Festival to hear performances from the Linley Hamilton Sextet and a local jazz legend, Gay McIntyre. Jazz Lineup, Sunday nights at 11 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Earlier in the evening, our sequence of words and music this week is on the theme of trees. Poetry and prose is interspersed with music by the Japanese composer Toru Takemitsu, Respighi, and song settings by Madeline Dring and Butterworth. I Love No Leafless Land, it's called. Our words and music sequence begins at 6:30 this evening. But it's now just 2 o'clock, time for our Sunday concert, presented by Nicola Haywood-Thomas.
Welcome to Swansea, where the principal conductor of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Thomas Sondergaard, is making his Brangwyn Hall debut. His programme includes Schumann's Fourth, described as a landmark in the history of the symphony, and the gloriously colourful violin concerto by Eric Korngold, perhaps better known for his film scores, with Daniel Hope as the soloist. First, though, we mark the bicentenary of Richard Wagner with the musical outpouring of Love and Contentment that he wrote as a birthday gift for his wife, Cosima, in 1870. The couple had fallen in love 7 years earlier, but were only married that year. They had 3 children and were living in a house overlooking Lake Lucerne. Cosima wrote in her diary, "When I woke up, I heard a sound. It grew ever louder. I could no longer imagine myself in a dream. Music was sounding, and what music!" It was the first performance of what became known later as the Siegfried Idyll, played by a small orchestra assembled on the staircase. Well, Thomas Sondergaard joins the somewhat larger forces of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales now to conduct Wagner's Siegfried Idyll.